world for many histories are true. But if so, I was certainly not in the right history in the past days, because I got a sore throat and I had a flight cancellation and so on. So it was bad luck. But nevertheless, I made it, and I want to thank the organizers for the invitation, and hope that now at least you are in the right branch of the multiverse. I will talk about multiversal pictures, science and science of other universes. And well, this perhaps is the past, universal pictures, and this could be the future. I don't know, but that's why we are here. So is the multiverse just a matter of faith? There was an edge question a couple of years ago called "What do you believe is true even though you cannot prove it?" And a lot of answers from about 120 were about the issue of other universes. And some of you were privileged to answer this question. So for example, Lee Smolin didn't say that he believes in other universes. He said something else, but it has to do with it. And so at least those seven people believe in some sense in other universes. But is it just a matter of belief, or can we do science about this? So why should we believe in other universes? Why do we believe in other universes? There could be empirical evidence. It could be that the theory forces us to do so, or there could be philosophical arguments, and perhaps there are other reasons. So if there is some empirical evidence, we have to remember David Hume's saying that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And I think we all agree that there is no such extraordinary evidence yet proving that other universes exist. Then theoretical reasons from quantum theory, many worlds or many histories, interpretation, we just thought about this, inflationary cosmology, other bubble or pocket universes, string theory, the landscape, and there are a lot of Big Bang explanations assuming that there are other universes. So if there is a kind of empirical connection between the data and some of those theories, we would at least have a stronger reason to believe in other universes. And then there are philosophical arguments, for example, the explanatory power and depth. So it's not about just so stories to explain, for example, the values of the constants of nature, but there could be some selection principles, either anthropic reasoning, which is a very weak kind of selection, or stronger forms of selection like Lee Smolin's cosmic Darwinism. Then there are reasons like we have to avoid any kind of anthropocentrism. We should be anti-geocentrism. So it would be the fulfillment of Copernicanism. That's wrong here. It's not anti. Believe that our universe is not alone. The principle of mediocrity from Alex Wilenking also assumes this. And there are deep and perhaps mysterious philosophical principles like the principle of vacuity or the principle of plenitude. It's not the same, but for our purposes, it's almost the same. Saying that everything which is possible is also real. So if other universes are possible, and in some sense they are, they might be real. So is this just philosophy, or is it also science? And where are the boundaries between those? So this is just motivation. Science and science of other universes. Can there be a science of other universes? Can there be a science in principle? A lot of people, perhaps more philosophers than cosmologists, say no. For example, because such a hypothesis cannot be falsified. So is this true? And even if so, is this relevant? So the question ultimately is, what is science? Does it depend on falsification? And others say, well, yes, and perhaps we are doing this science of other universes already, for example, here in this room. So there are signs of science, for example, signs of other universes. Are there such signs? And the other question, can there be signs of other universes? Can we detect and recognize them? So is there a science of science, that is a science of finding signs of other universes? So the first question is quite easy. Are other universes a legitimate object of science? As long as it is pure speculation without any observational evidence, we have to distinguish between objects and theories or hypotheses about objects. It can and should not be demanded that the existence of objects is established or even proven for taking them as a legitimate part of science. This would be an unreasonable restriction. The hypothetical character of science and scientific progress ultimately demands thinking about not established or not yet proven entities. Think of the example of atoms, for example. Before they were actually discovered. So their still speculative status does not imply that other universes are not a legitimate object of science. But of course, this does not necessarily mean that they are such an object. That is, further arguments are required. So are other universes a legitimate part of science? If so, why? If not, what are they? And again, what is science? My short answer for this question is yes. And the longer and hopefully more interesting answer is, it depends. It depends on what universe means. Not all kind of claims of other universes can be part of science. Depends on what science means. And then if they are part of, why? I shall review and discuss some of the arguments. If not, why are they? What are they? I shall discuss other options. And then I will not even try to answer the question what science is, but I shall discuss some useful criteria for this. So from a philosophy of science point of view, the challenge of other universes is helpful for even for a better understanding what science is. There are at least three perspectives of scientific reasoning and science. The first, just a sociological perspective, social practice, what scientists do as scientists, not as some other business, of course. And what is published and usually peer-reviewed science journals and published books. Then the methodological perspective. And here we need some demarcation criteria, for example, being intersubjective or reproducible or even falsifiable. And then a topical perspective relating to well-established disciplines. So in respect of the sociological perspective, other universes are definitely a part of science. We are thinking about other universes, and we are scientists, so in this respect it's easy. But of course that is not very helpful. The topical perspective, yes and no, but at least there is an increasing kind of discipline in cosmology which we should allow for change and additions, so other universes have a kind of place in cosmology already. And the most relevant question, of course, is the methodological one. The criteria are somewhat arbitrary, controversial, evolving, too restrictive, too special, and so on. And also the problem is, are they necessary or are they sufficient for science? So I will talk about this criteria. Falsifiability, that is to falsify statements, is at the heart of natural science, as we have learned from Karl Popper. Scientific statements referring to reality must be falsifiable. Already in 1932, Karl Popper wrote, and he suggested that this is a demarcation criterion of science, in contrast to metaphysics or logic or pseudoscience. But falsifiability of theoretical systems is the issue, or at least of some parts of such a system, and not of single statements. So if we make the statement there are other universes, it in some sense does not apply to this criteria. Scientific laws must be falsifiable, for example, Newton's law, but hypothetical universal existence statements need not to be falsifiable. For example, and they even cannot be falsifiable, but they, excuse me, just let me complete this sentence, but they must be verified. Okay, so who was first?
Okay, so I was just worrying about the apparent conflict between your second and third bullet points. So your second bullet point says, okay, when I say stuff must be falsifiable, I mean some big theoretical system, not a single state. And then you say scientific laws must be falsified, for example, Newton's law, but that's a single statement. So how can I believe both of your second and third points? I agree with the second and not with the third instead.
No, the law is not taken as a statement. It's taken as a theory. It's not taken as a universal existence statement, singular sentence. So if you say hafnium, the element 72 is. So okay, say it again.
Okay, so your second bullet point says, when I say stuff must be falsifiable, by stuff I mean entire theoretical system,
yeah.
Not single statement. Okay. And then your third bullet point says scientific laws must be falsifiable. But individual scientific laws are typically going to be single statements or something similar.
Well, you cannot. Yeah, well, it's difficult. If you treat them like that, okay, that's a problem. But you cannot. You can treat them otherwise. You can say this is a. It's not a single statement, it's a universal general statement. So it's.
Okay.
So it's not
as a universal generalization, then it is reasonable to exist that that single statement be falsifiable in isolation.
Yeah.
I defer to David if I have something to say. I think I'm pressing the same point as Hillary was trying to press. Look, in among philosophers, I mean, this falsification criterion was subjected to an avalanche of, I think, pretty effective criticism since Popper wrote it. The criticism seems to be what you're alluding to in your second bullet point. That is, the typical critique was, Popper thought he had this great idea. Okay, induction doesn't work. You can't prove the theory. You can't empirically prove the theories are true. Is there then any account of scientific progress that we can make? Yes, the idea was there's an asymmetry between verifying a theory and falsifying it. No finite number of observations can verify a theory with an infinite number of consequences. But a finite number of observations, indeed a single observation, can falsify a theory. Okay? If I make a measurement and it comes out other than the way the law predicted, I've got a falsification. More or less the minute this was written, an avalanche of people came in and said, look, that's not, there isn't this asymmetry that you think there is, okay? You make a measurement, you're taking for granted as confirmed certain claims about the way your measurement apparatus interacts with the world, what a certain registration on your screen means, so on and so forth. There are all sorts of theories of these things, okay, which need to be granted as confirmed before you've got yourself a falsification of the theory you were trying to test, okay? So in response to this, there grew up so-called holist attitudes, okay? An experiment comes out the way you don't expect. You know that something's wrong somewhere in the entire, in your entire theoretical view of the world, but the business of localizing it better than that is very, very problematic. And the idea that there is some clean notion of falsification that doesn't depend on confirmation, that isn't parasitic on confirmation, I think has been demolished. In philosophical.
Yeah, I do not have thoughts about this. I'm not subscribing to Popper to this kind of view. I just wanted to say that even if we adopt this very strong and restrictive view, we still can say that other universes are are legitimate part of science. That's all I want to say. And I will come back to some of these issues. So it's a historical and it's also a systematical approach, and I will not subscribe, I do not subscribe to this, but I appreciate your comment and agree with it.
Someone wants to add something?
Let me see if I can make a minimal version of the statement that everybody agrees upon. A scientific, Popper's relevant, a scientific theory to be a plausible candidate for our belief about the truth of the world ought to make some specific predictions for experiments which are either confirmable or falsifiable. And if it makes no such predictions, so I agree the asymmetry is wrong. If the claim that a theory is a scientific theory makes no specific predictions that are either confirmable or falsifiable, then it has a questionable claim on our interest as a scientist.
I hate to sound so much like a philosopher here, but there is a bit of a technical terminology that's grown up about this. If you were to replace falsifiable by disconfirmable, just to introduce people to terminology, falsifiable means there's an experiment you could point to which would prove it definitively false. Verifiable is usually used by philosophers to mean there's an experiment you could point to that would prove it definitively true. I think what most people believe is that neither of those ever happen. But the following thing does happen. There are all kinds of pieces of evidence you can point to which count significantly in favor of the theory, and there are all kinds of pieces of hypothetical evidence you can point to which count significantly against the theory. And if a theory is not susceptible to either of those two processes, then it's not of scientific interest. Right. That sounds right to me. I mean, is that an acceptable modification of what you wanted to say? Right. Good.
What I wanted to ask about this is whether the key thing that might be true of some of these multiverse theories is something that would be considered falsifiable or not falsifiable or scientific by any of these criteria. And the key thing that is, I think, a little bit disturbing about some of these things is that it's possible that these theories will predict nothing about the observable world that we can't predict in another way, except that in the other way, we'll have to add some parameter into the theory, which is free, and we have to choose an unlikely looking value for that parameter as the correct one that fits the data in the real world. And the multiverse theory does nothing except explain why that unlikely looking value is realized. Is that, by some philosopher's definition, science or not?
I would say it's science. We all know that there is always the case that there are more theories than data. So there is an underdetermination or an overdetermination by theories and data. And it could be that we never know, but it's not an argument against being a subject of science. It's just an argument about, can we know whether other universes exist or not? It's not that is not an argument that that they are not a part of science. So this is just a.
I wanted to propose another modification to Lisa. So if you want to come back on this, you should probably go first.
Okay. So my answer is no in the following sense. Let me just restate what you said. There's a parameter whose value we would like to understand. Okay. Theory A, that the probability of its value that's observed is low. Okay. Theory B, the probability that's observed for the probability for the value we observe is high. And this is all we know to distinguish theories A and theory B. There are no further experimental predictions which might distinguish between A and B. Does this increase the probability that theory B is true over theory A? The fact that it predicts that the observed value is more probable, okay, you're asserting there is such a case. Okay, and I think what I would like to say is that that's a weak kind of argument that does increase our interest in theory B over what it otherwise would have been, but it can't be taken as confirming the hypothesis of theory B. That is, it increases our interest, but nonetheless, theory B still has the burden of making additional predictions which are up or down checkable. And if that's all theory B does, this is not enough to cause, it's enough to cause interest in theory B, but not enough to confirm its hypothesis.
Well, the situation you're talking about is not exactly the situation we're in. The situation we're in is one in which theory A puts the parameter in by hand, doesn't pretend to explain it, and puts it in with a value that everybody feels uncomfortable with. And theory B pretends to concoct a big theoretical structure which explains to you why you might expect to get that unlikely looking value, but has no other consequences whatsoever.
Right. So I think what I would like to say about that case is that this is not nothing. This points to interest in theory B, but it does not confirm its hypothesis.
Oh, of course.
And the burden on us is to drag out one way or another of theory B some real prediction which is specific and be confirmed or not, or look in the future for some theory C which does what theory B does but also does that.
Okay, so just going back to the criterion. Okay, so first class was for the theory to count as scientific, it has to be falsifiable. So, and then we say, no, that's too stringent. Second class, it has to be disconfirmable. So my third class is, I want to incorporate the holism as well. Yes, it has to be disconfirmable, but it doesn't have to do it on its own. It's allowed to make use of auxiliary hypotheses. So it can be that the theory, together with various auxiliary hypotheses as a whole, is disconfirmable. Well,
that's the real world we live in. That's the way it always happens.
Right, but I think it's topical because some of those auxiliary hypotheses could be particular measures on the set of universes or whatever.
Yes, and the whole package is disconfirmable.
Right.
Yes.
Check to see if the fact that the universe exists is a popular subject in science fiction books. In my opinion, that's where it belongs. It doesn't belong in the kind of physics we can do, it's just kind of real. But there's no possibility in my opinion of observing the universe. It's difficult enough observing the world we live in. I'm trying to understand it. And that's what we should do first before we start worrying about the universe.
Well, I think this is a statement.
But it's not the first time we borrow from science fiction, is it?
Don't get killed.
Even wormholes were invented in science fiction, and now they are part of science fiction that people have to study. Whether they are existing or not is a completely different story. So at the moment, I'm just talking about this science stuff. It's not about whether the other universes exist. And of course, I'm not the person who can judge this. I'm not a cosmologist observing science of other universes. So my part is not about this. I'm just trying to clarify what we are talking about, what is the connection between philosophy and science, and what is the status of claims or statements about our universe's relationship to science and non-science, or even nonsense.
Question of what a universe or our universe or universe is and means, which is the first question that he brought up, comes into play, because if we actually find that there are other implications, that there are observable phenomena that we can't account for by our definition of what quote unquote our universe as we now define it is, we can call them other universes, we can call them extensions of our universe, or we can call them other dimensions. But it then becomes obvious that we have not arrived at the finality of reality or universe or whatever we want to call it. So we're calling it a multiverse. Lenny Susskind is talking about the possibility of seeing gravitational lensing at the CMB of other influences on what we're calling our universe or universe as we know it. So we're calling it other universes, but we're trying to find the limits of reality, whether it's other universes or universes, and we're looking for any implications we can find with the LHC or with the CMB or anything else. But to put it, okay, that's science fiction. This is like, all we're trying to do is find out the limits of reality and to extend our possibility of reality and then to see what we can understand without all these words that put limits on.
There's no reason why we shouldn't extend our beliefs. Because the demarcation between religion and science, as we've had it done since Galileo, that you can have beliefs in religion, and that's fine. We all have beliefs. But the difference with science, as we call it, is you can verify, falsify, and give a prediction. And the two should be separated from one another.
Yes, I fully agree. That's
the master of math and practice.
Maybe you should not.
The real world is, in fact, a lot messier than that in practice.
Not for me in science. No.
I mean, what like other sciences? What about economics? Is that a science? In the States, it is. In Canada, it's not. If you base it on funding agencies, they can't make the same level of predictive power that we would expect in physics. Yet, I think there are some people who would consider it sometimes science.
But take quantum relation as marriage.
I think maybe
it's one of the most.
I think you should.
Yeah, we should.
Okay, so what I just said is that even if we adopt to Popperian falsificationism, we still can say that other universes are parts of science because if we treat them as an existential, as a single existential statement, then it need not, it cannot be falsifiable, but it must be verified. And then we have to find ways how to verify it. So, nevertheless, this is not sufficient. Otherwise, fictive ghosts or unicorns or other fictive elements would also be part of science. And probably they are not. So there is another criteria necessary, that is theoretical embedding. For example, if you believe in wormholes, then we cannot falsify wormholes because it's just an hypothetical universal existence statement, but we, in principle, could verify the existence of wormholes, for example, by their gravitational lensing effect, and we have an embedding background, a theory, namely relativity, to describe those wormholes.
This is just a clarificatory question, and it probably shows that I've taken too many formal logic courses. I'm having trouble understanding the locution universal existence statement. So normally there's a distinction between universal statements which say for all x, blah, 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 and existence statements which say no existence x, which is blah, blah, blah. So how am I supposed to understand?
So universal is about the
universal existence statement thing?
Universal is just about everything, and existence is that it's existent. So you can also say generalized.
So if I say there exists at least one atom of hafnium, is that a universal existence statement or just an existence statement?
Both.
What's universal about it?
It's universal about if you take it as a sentence about the whole universe, or about the whole reality.
So what would be a sentence that's not about the universe?
I think that's not the point here. But perhaps we could discuss this later. So nothing depends on this. Okay, David Albert already said that Popper's views are not general enough. So time goes by and research programs appeared. And Lakatos, for example, stressed that it's not about reputations in general, but reputations are not a sign of empirical progress because research programs grow in a permanent ocean of anomalies. So they are permanently signs of reputations on the way because data are bad and are misinterpreted and so on. But nevertheless, we should give theories a chance to develop, to get rid of errors, to get more complete. Often theories are ahead of data, so that is for observers get data and for theorists make testable predictions again. And Lakatos adopted a sophisticated form of falsificationism, struggle between theories and data interpretation, a quasi-Darwinistic one. And if there are problems, we should modify the periphery first, for example, by adopting auxiliary assumptions and save the core of the theory as long as we can. And of course, new problems come. For example, we could make immunizations against every kind of falsification. And then it's not a part of science anymore. So it's a difficult boundary. But nevertheless, we should not throw out theories before they are good in a good shape and developed and had a chance to get tested. And there are a lot of criteria for successful research programs. For example, many applications, novel predictions, new technologies, answering unsolved questions, consistency, elegance, simplicity, explanatory power, unification of distinct phenomena, and truth. But what about the multiverse here? Many applications, well, no. Novel predictions, perhaps yes. New technologies, at least not yet. Answering unsolved questions, yes. Consistency, hopefully. Elegance, well, depends on your taste. Simplicity, probably yes. Explanatory power, in some sense, yes. Depending on what you want to explain, I'm coming back to this. Unification of distinct phenomenon, yes. And well, truth, that's of course the question. And if you can catch truth, how can you do it? Perhaps by applying the other criteria. So there's a kind of circle in this. And then we have the demarcation problem again. Distinguish natural science to other kinds of knowledge and practice. So I think I will skip this because of time restrictions. We need criteria not only to distinguish science from metaphysics or religion or other belief systems. And if you say other universes are a kind of metaphysical statement, then you have distinguished such statements from scientific statements. But you also have to distinguish scientific statements from voodoo science, as it called, for example, pseudoscience or other kinds of voodoo science. And then there is a shifting boundary between science and scientific speculation or fringe science. And what starts as scientific speculation, for example, other universes can move into science, or they move into metaphysics, for example, depending on how the actual research is going on. So I made a big list contrasting science or features of science from pseudoscience and different kinds of science, different kinds of pseudoscience. And at least you can quickly look at those points. Many of them, if they are applicable, are speaking in favor of other universes being a kind part of science. And there's another list. So my last point is systematicity, which is a new work just published by Paul Heuning and Hühne. And he tries to understand what science is in respect of nine distinct criteria: descriptions, explanations, predictions, the defense of knowledge claims, epistemic connectedness, an ideal of completeness, knowledge generation, the representation of knowledge, and critical discourse. And he claims that those criteria have to be fulfilled for every kind of science, even economics or the science of chocolate or something like this, distinguishing them from just practice. And I think this is quite reasonable. And you see there a falsification or verification has a place in this, namely in predictions or in knowledge generation and so on, and the defense of knowledge claims. But there are kinds of science which do not make predictions, of course, at least not in the usual sense. For example, historical science. So if you would take them as science too, then you have to widen your perspective and you have to widen your criteria. And in if you adopt those criteria and you look whether other universes have a place in this, then you can find in any case that the criteria Heuning and Hühne has come up with are consistent with other universes. So in that respect, other universes are also a part of science. Of course, this is just where the controversy begins. Now in science, other universes, like them or not, might be the implication of a slippery slope argument, as for example, Martin Rees has argued. He said, well, there are galaxies beyond our telescopes, the limits, the technical limits of our telescopes, but we treat them as real. And if we have better telescopes, we will see them. Then there are galaxies beyond our horizon. We will never see them, but we have nevertheless reasons to believe that they are real. And some philosophers or scientists could say, well, no, there is no way of observing them. So it's a metaphysical claim. And then the next step would be, well, there are universes beyond our universe. And so you are falling down the slippery slope. Then you could say the implication, the other universes are implications of a well-established theory, or the ultimate anti-anthropocentrism, or an important explanance, or a part of an explanance, for example, explaining Big Bang, the fine-tuning of nature constants, quantum measurement problem, or that there are no time paradoxes, because if there are time machines, perhaps they lead into other universes. All this was argued. So is this a physical extravagance? Yes, but there are many other extravagances in relativity in quantum theory. Is it a straightforward explanation or a transcendence of speculative reason? Is it an explanation of anything and therefore nothing, or is it just an explanation of something? Is it against simplicity or parsimony, that is against Occam's razor? Well, you could say there are many objects, namely many universes, but there might be a parsimony in some other respect, namely in relation to principles, restrictions, algorithms, kinds of entities, etc. Then there might be a problem with actual infinities. George Ellis, for example, claimed this. And as I already said, there is the principle of plentitude. Everything is real if it's not explicitly forbidden by laws of nature, for example, symmetry principles. And that was the position of Richard Feynman and others. It goes back to a quote in the novel The Once and Future King by Terence White. So the question, of course, is what is forbidden? How can we know this? And there's also a slippery slope, as Paul Davis told us. There could be, in principle, universes containing magic, or some with a god, almighty, and so on, some not, some with simulations of every wild fantasy. So you cannot say, because of the principle of plentitude, that everything which we can imagine is therefore a priori real. There have to be some restrictions. Okay, so now this was quite an abstract discussion. So now I will be a little bit more concrete. Brief history of multiverse. The this, as I know, the term was coined by William James in completely other context. And in 1960, it was invented in a talk about the many worlds interpretation, which was given in 1961 with just the opposite of its meaning now. That is an apparent universe, a multiplicity of which go to make up the whole universe. This was because the then dictionary definition of the word universe was all that there is. Then Michael Moorcock, and here we are actually in science fiction, used multiverse as the totality of all universes in his Eternal Champion short stories and in his novel The Blood Red Game. There were other science fiction novels in that respect too earlier. And then David Deutsch read Moorcock's novel and introduced the multiverse into quantum physics in the opposite meaning of the earlier suggestion. So we heard a lot of many worlds and perhaps many worlds. And then also in cosmology, multiverse issues came up in cyclic or oscillating universes, eternal inflation, brain worlds, landscape. So the first probably was eternal recurrence in philosophy, in Nietzsche's thinking, and it also came back in cosmology, in the, for example, in speculations by Alexander Vilenkin about many worlds in one, claiming that if the universe is infinite in time or in space or both, then if there are there is no continuum of different states, but if they are quantized, then by necessity there must be duplicates, doppelganger, and even duplicate universes, Hubble universes. And Max Tegmark estimated how far they are apart. So it's a very large distance, but it's not infinite. Yes?
Estimates. I think you need the brackets around the,
oh, yeah,
to the 29,
yeah,
not around,
right,
the 10 to the 10.
It's right.
It's 10 to the 10.
10 to the, yes, right.
Okay, and likewise for the
other. Yeah, you are right.
Sorry, I know, sorry, that's a good.
Sorry.
What's
the mistake?
It is a bit bigger when you do
it. It's a bit bigger, nevertheless, yeah. So if you say, well, our universe is just the Hubble volume, about 46 billion light years in radius, then you have reason to believe that there are other patches, other Hubble volumes beyond this horizon, and if you would like, you can call them other universes. Also, there is a continuity between us and those other universes. But if they are disconnected, at least at the moment, many people say, well, there are other universes in that respect. And if you believe in inflation, not eternal inflation by necessity, then our universe is just a little patch in a much bigger universe. And again, you can say the other parts are other universes, but this is not very interesting because it's just about definitions. And I will not go into this. Then baby universes, recycling universe, well, the Big Bang as an experiment of cosmic cosmic designers. Quantum universes coming up of a kind of quantum vacuum. For example, the pre-Big Bang cosmology by Gasparini or in Veneziano, or Richard Gott's ideas about a time loop at the very beginning and then inflationary multiverse. And there were even some speculations if the dark energy is a kind of phantom energy, that our universe will get sucked into a wormhole and pushed into another universe, or that even the wormhole can work as a kind of time machine, and the far future is also the beginning of our universe, so this would be a kind of time loop, universal time loop again. All this was invented in science fiction, by the way, much earlier. So the question is, what do we take out of this? There are different notions of the term Big Bang. First, the hot, dense, early phase of our universe, where the light elements were formed. A different notion is the initial singularity. A third notion is an absolute beginning of space, time, and energy. And a fourth notion is the beginning of our universe, that is the elementary particles, vacuum state, and perhaps its local space-time. So it's very important not to confuse those four notions. That our universe originated from a Big Bang in the sense of one is almost uncontroversial. The second notion, the initial singularity, is just the relativistic cosmology's limit of backwards extrapolation, where the known laws of physics inevitably break down. The singularity is a mathematical limit where density and temperature and so on goes to infinity, but it's not a real point or something real in out there. It's just a limit of our knowledge or of our theory. So different models of quantum and string cosmology or theory of quantum gravity try to overcome this limit, and that's why we can use the other two notions of Big Bang. So there are initial cosmologies with an absolute beginning of time, and there are eternal cosmologies, but those notion allows at least that there was a kind of time before the Big Bang, in the sense of Big Bang number one, and as well as that there are other universes. So it could well be that the Big Bang is just a transition in a larger cosmos and not the beginning of everything, and that we have to adopt the multiverse hypothesis to understand this. Then there is a cosmic trinity model by God, with matter universe, antimatter universe, and tachyon universe. I will skip this. Then there's eternal inflation. You know all about this. Then there's the landscape. Then there is a marriage between the eternal inflation and landscape picture. Andre Linde, last year in the very early universe conference, 25 years on, said eternal inflation and string theory joined each other in the context of the string theory landscape. The resulting picture changes the way we look at our place in the world. This is one of the most exciting and mysterious parts of modern science. But it's not sure whether this marriage is a happy one. Then, in contrast to this, there are other options, other theories, like the cyclic universe by Steinhardt and Turok, avoiding inflation and the stringscape, and nevertheless adopt the existence of other universes, those other brain. So there are different notions of universe, and that's also a kind of a source of confusion. First, everything physically in existence, ever, anywhere. So in that sense, there could be no multiverse distinct of the universe. Then the observable region we inhabit, this Hubble volume. Third, a gigantic system and causally interacting things that is wholly isolated from others, or at least to a very large extent. Fourth, any system that might well have become gigantic. Fifth, separate branches of the wave function. And sixth, completely disconnected systems consisting of other universes in one of the former meanings, two, three, four, or five, which do or do not share the same boundary conditions, constants, parameters, and so on. So with the first definition, there is by definition no there are no universes by definition. But this is also not interesting. In principle, other universes mostly conceived in the notions of 2, 3, or 4 might or might not be spatially, temporally, dimensionally, and or mathematically separated from each other. So thus, there are not necessarily sharp boundaries between them. And nowadays, we use the word multiverse or cosmos as a world as a whole for referring to everything in existence. But there's still another ambiguity if there are disconnected multiverses, so to speak, which is a metaphysical statement now, and not a scientific one, because there is no way to know of those disconnected other multiverses. Then we still need another term in the hierarchy, so we could say omniverse or just cosm. And then there are different kinds of taxonomies. Going back to this Paul Heuning and Hühne stuff, there one in systematicity, there was one point to describe things. And so you have to do taxonomical work, like in botany, for example. And there are different kinds of suggestions around. We talked yesterday about Max Tegmark's views about those 4 levels. I will not repeat this. And he had also a metaphysical claim connected with this, namely that ultimately Platonism is true. So there, what's really out there are mathematical structures, and some of them are instantiated as physical universe. And you see, this is not science anymore in some respect. Nevertheless, Max Tegmark, of course, is a scientist. So there are boundaries, and there are connections between metaphysics and science. And then Laura yesterday told us about her distinction of those 3 kinds of multiversals. And I would like to suggest another one, another taxonomy, which should be abstract enough to include all kinds of cosmological scenarios. So the suggestion is we should classify the different kinds of universes in respect of the separation or distinction of those different universes, in respect of their spatial, temporal, causal, modal, and mathematical distinction. And those distinctions, those separations are not exclusive in any aspect, some are. And of course, this is just a conceptual issue. It proves or explains nothing. So the question is it useful? Is it sufficiently complete? Is it not too arbitrary? Rutherford once remarked that science is either physics or collecting stamps. So perhaps this is just stamp collections, but nevertheless, this is the taxonomy I'm suggesting. So there is a kind of separation, some aspects of it, and then these are some examples and comments. Spatial-temporal separation, spatial-temporal dimensional, causal, strict or continuous, modal, referring to just potential or possible, or actual and real. So for example, in philosophy, modal realism is here. Then nomological, referring to different laws or constants. And this mathematical stuff, referring to Max Tegmark's view. And then you can fine grain this, whether the universes are exclusive, that is separated spatially, or inclusive, kind of embedding universes in atoms or in black holes, or even in computer simulations. The temporal distinction is about a series in time, And then there's the issue whether the time is linear or is cyclic. The dimensional separation is mostly meant in a special context. So there could be parallel worlds, strictly speaking, perhaps separated by a higher dimension. But it could also be just abstract kinds of universes, like the Wheeler-Lees in superspace approach. Then the causal issue, of course, is connected with the spatial one and the temporal one. Strict causal distinctions without a common generator or with such a generator, so genealogical series like an internal inflation or cosmic Darwinism. Then if there are continuity between causal effects, perhaps due to the increasing horizon, it might be all the time, or just in the past, or just in the future. And then there's this simulation problem also, which I will not address. So I hope this kind of taxonomy is complete enough to cover every kind of other universe scenario. So signs of other universes. If we accept that we should make predictions and we should be able to test those predictions, we could imagine how in what way we could in principle find signs of other universes. Of course, this is the hard part, and it's not up to me to judge this and to think about this as a philosopher of science. But there are, in principle, some ways to test or to prove that existential claims. For example, if there are wormholes which connect different universes, and perhaps we could even travel to another universe, or in the framework of eternal inflation, there is new work saying that it at least is possible that there are some colliding bubbles and that there are signatures of those collisions, and perhaps we will detect them in the sky. That is, for example, in the cosmic microwave background. There's active research going on at the moment to make predictions. How could such bubble collisions look like? I will not say that this is really a promising approach. I'm agnostic, but at least you can see that in such a framework, we are, in principle, it is in principle possible to make predictions, and it is also possible to test them. And then there is the void issue Laura yesterday talked about. So there is this cold spot in the WMAP map of the cosmic microwave background, and it's perhaps correlated with a lower temperature in the radio background. And Laura predicted those voids, two of them, and one could be behind this. So this is also, it might be true or not, but it's at least a very reasonable kind of approach how to see how other universes could leave a trace in our universe and how we could test it. So this is going back to the verification issue, a kind of verification in principle. There are other explanations, of course, if the data are true and so on. This is another story, for example, being a texture. But even if it's not a void, there are other possibilities, like textures which nevertheless could be could be in in a co- could be connected with the multiverse view, namely that there is a kind of hole in our brain connecting our brain with another brain, so it would be a gate, so to speak, to another universe. So this is, of course, also just speculation at the moment, but at least it has to do with other universes. Okay, I'm almost through now. I wanted to convince you that there is a kind of science of other universes. That is, that talking about other universes is legitimate in respect of scientific criteria and also in respect of philosophical issues, of philosophy of science issues. And we should take the option that other universes exist as a serious one. It's not just speculation. It's not just pure science fiction. It can be tested, perhaps. And it has, at least according to the different kinds of criteria I reviewed, it has a place in our scientific framework. So in that sense, I would say there is a science of other universes, and there are also signs of other universes, at least in a hypothetical context. And Paul Davis yesterday told about turtles and ultimate explanations. And if there are other universes, they very well may play a role in such a kind of investigation that is going one or even more turtles deeper. But of course, the issue is whether this leads to an ultimate turtle, an ultimate explanation, an ultimate truth, or not. And in the philosophy of science and epistemology discussions, there is this Münchhausen trilemma, coined by Hans Albert, which goes, in fact, back to the ancient philosophers like Sextus Empiricus, saying that there are only three kinds of reasoning or justification or of explanation. Ultimately, we have to stop or break, or we have an infinite regress, infinite turtles, or we have a logical circle. And everything, every option of those three is not a good one, because if we stop, we have to assume something. But why should we assume this? If we have an infinite regress, we will never be finished. And if it's a cycle, we go in cycles and perhaps are just in a kind of madness house, which is internal consistent, but perhaps not true. So in that respect, we have to be modest. There is no ultimate explanation, even with other universes. There is ultimate contingency, that is, there is no sufficient reason, there's no final explanation. But the good news, of course, is that therefore science may never stop. This Münchhausen's trilemma was meant by Hans Albert in the epistemological sense, but we can find it in cosmology also. So this is a metaphorical transition now, or in an ontology. The stop in our cosmological models is the singularity, or our models with beginning of time. The infinite regress is, so to speak, the eternal universe, either as a series or as a cycle. And the logical circle corresponds corresponds to this self-creation models with a time loop, or the universe as a time machine, as I briefly mentioned it. So it's quite interesting that all the options are realized both in epistemology and also in cosmological ontology. Our mistake is not that we take our theories too seriously, but that we do not take them serious enough. There's also a word missing. Steven Weinberg told us, and I think that this is a good advice. Thanks for listening.
I wonder if you could comment a little more about what you said earlier about Occam's razor. Do you think that an unbounded, or maybe unbounded is too strong, but an arbitrarily large amount of physical material as an assumption for a theory violates Occam's razor?
No.
I didn't think you were clear on that.
No, no, I don't think so. The difficulty is, of course, that Occam's razor is an ambiguous term. Different people have different connections with this. Actually, Occam didn't even say something like this, but it's another story. If you say Occam's razor is about entities, you still have to distinguish between entities of the same kind or the same type, like universes or stuff, and entities of different kinds. So, for example, you can say, well, the physical world is all there is. If we believe in angels or gods, we have to cut them. That's Occam's razor. But other people say, even other universes are too costly, so we have to cut them. So in that respect, other universes would violate Occam's razor, but in some other respects, they do not violate Occam's razor. For example, if there is a parsimony of principles or of generation mechanisms, so there could be a single principle which generate an infinite number of universes, and the number is not economical, but the principle would be. So Occam's razor is relative, depending on the application.
Yeah, I just wonder, I mean, I actually don't know that I fully agree with that, because the usual debate is Occam's razor is about parsimony of principle instead of parsimony of stuff. But the problem I have with that is that even with the known laws of physics now, if you give me enough stuff and I can shuffle around the initial conditions, I can get pretty much anything I want to happen to actually happen. And so it strikes me as a bit solipsistic that, I mean, this, the assumption that the universe is my dream is a parsimonious assumption. It's one assumption, but its explanatory power seems to me to be, let's say, not very good. And so I'm concerned that the notion of introducing as much material as you want to explain a given phenomenon is cheating. People would say, I only have a few assumptions, but if you give me enough stuff, I can, the Wild West rules, I can basically do almost anything I want. Do you think that's reasonable? Or?
Well, it depends on. For example, the duplicate or doppelganger universe of Alex Wilenking, of course, is exactly this issue. But nevertheless, it's not a problem in some other respect. Or if you say, well, we believe in eternal inflation, we believe in quantum physics. Only those two principles we need, and we have, of course, everything of this world stuff and all the different initial conditions. But it's nevertheless in accordance with Occam's razor. So I would not, I would say, depends just on what you want and what you criticize.
Lee?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate a lot of what you said, but for me, the perspective is way off. And let me explain. I think your last quote and what you just said is a good taking point. I think we are in trouble because we're taking our existing theories way too seriously, and it's insufficiently appreciated the extent to which we're on very shaky ground when we extrapolate the theories that we have that have tremendous empirical adequacy, such as the standard model, such as classical general relativity, such as the standard theory of the early universe, including ordinary inflation. Right? And eternal inflation is exactly a case where you extrapolate those assumptions. Okay? It's fair game to play a game as a theorist and extrapolate those assumptions. And you open a door into a situation in which, on one side of the door, the side that observational cosmology is on, it's an enormously golden period of empirically adequate theories making good contact with experiment and with observation. And you go through this door, okay, and all of a sudden we're in this never-never world where we have to talk about all the boundary between science and not science, demarcation, all these things. Okay. One thing that's certainly true is that, science, which is real science, is stable under the different notions of demarcation, the different theories of adequacy, and so forth. Real science is not affected by a change in the attitude towards what is science. It's stable. Okay. And when we get into a domain where we have to worry and have a fine discussion, I mean, I'm very interested for other reasons in the methodology of science and Popper and McIntosh and Kuhn and Fajon, but if I have to bring those into a discussion of whether I'm doing science, I'm in trouble. Okay. And I think what's missing is the tension.
That's a good definition of science, actually.
What's missing is the tension between the reasons why many of us feel pushed to speculate about many universes, and I'm among them, and many people are among them. The tension between that and the tremendous decrease in the quality of the empirical adequacy or the promise of empirical adequacy that we bring about that. And there's a strong tension between, which you didn't bring, why is talk of multiverses common among cosmologists? There are reasons for it. There are things, there are puzzles that we have that it seems the only avenue, as Tom was indicating in his remarks during this time, it seems the only avenue is to open this door. But at the same time, opening this door, we should be cognizant that it's, we're taking a tremendously risky step, okay? And we're doing that at a moment when cosmology is doing tremendously well on its own. And I think what I would hope for from philosophers and historians of science is a lot more stern guidance, not a kind of anything goes and this is that and this is possible. And the question of what may scientists discuss is a very weak criteria. The question of what do we have to do in our perilous situation to move these speculations into the domain of real science is a daunting prospect. And I would hope for, for real advice about that and mindful of what a bad situation we're in.
So it's very difficult to be normative. And what you just wish this, that philosophers of science should be normative, saying this is good science and this is perhaps not so good science.
Well, to raise an example, okay, a thing that philosophers are trained to do, okay, is make clear arguments and separate out fallacies within argumentation.
Right.
Okay. The literature in this field is filled with confusion, fallacies of various kinds. And what I would like to see from philosophers is critical literature, which is not, it's not critical, taking some of the key papers in which some of us, explain why we feel forced to speculate about many universes and ripping us apart and saying, no, that's a fallacy, that's inadequate reasoning, that's silly. Okay. That would help the discussion.
True, but scientists are not that silly to just to make that those fallacies.
But we can't all be, if there's 13 different versions of it.
Yeah, sure, for example, you are also doing such kind of philosophical work.
But
I'm attacking the anthropic principle.
Yeah, but I'm an amateur. Well, I do that because the profession, I don't see the...
You're quite good for being an amateur. So
I'm serious. What I don't see is professionals,
David, just to get personal, David could tear all the stuff to mincemeat if he wanted to, with his critical facilities and other people with like training and skills. And I'd like to see some of that, more of that. There are a few papers here and there, but I'd like to see more of that.
Yes, well, what you would also perhaps suggesting is that it's even unscientific to go to this avenue, for example,
if you want to talk about, okay, I have my, according to my demarcation criteria, okay, what well-trained accredited scientists do when they feel forced to introduce new speculations is an important part of science, but there has to be an important realization of how, you know, risky and speculative this is,
right. Okay,
as opposed to what most of cosmologists are doing, which is detailed confirmation of detailed theories with observation.
Yes.
I mean, in a meeting like this, you can get the idea that cosmology is a very, you know, weird, speculative, far-off subject, but most of the cosmology meetings we have here, okay, there's lots and lots of data and confrontation of theory and data going.
So I fully agree with this, and I think there's much more work to be done about this demarcation criteria, and not just as I did now in the abstract sense, but in a much more concrete sense. That is doing case studies, looking for those boundaries and say, well, is it more science? Is it more scientific speculation? What are the criteria for this? Is it fringe science or not? Is it thermal inflation up to a moment scientific speculation? And then to go one step further, is it not? But look,
What are the
criteria for this? And, should philosophers of science be prescriptive? I don't think so.
No, it should be. But so not is eternal inflation science, okay, but what precisely needs to happen so that eternal inflation can be reformed into an empirically adequate theory that confronts data? Right. And how might we go about that? That's the kind of advice we need.
Sure, yes.
Look, just to maybe to attempt to initiate one version of the kind of discussion that Lee was asking for, which is a discussion, and maybe some of this discussion was at yesterday, which I missed, but this is some of the discussion I was looking forward to having at a meeting like this. Here's something that I think is puzzling to philosophers about a lot of the multiverse. This isn't about many worlds, but about other kinds of multiverse speculation. A lot of it, a lot of it seems to originate in some kind of observation to the effect that the world as we're presented with it looks unlikely or implausible or the sort of thing with which one ought to associate a low probability. And this is a kind of reasoning which is very puzzling to me and very puzzling to lots of philosophers in the following, and the kind of reasoning which one would like to hear much more about.
Which part of it, sir?
That somebody says the world as it presents itself to us seems to say that this constant is within this very narrow range. Okay, that seems implausible. And let me expand the statement a little bit, and people can tell me if I'm expanding it correctly. That seems, in some a priori sense, implausible. Okay, that is, there is a kind of reasoning about probability which philosophers call the principle of indifference, where you say if there are no principles governing what the value of such and such ought to be. One ought to associate equal probabilities with its being in this range or with its being in that range, where those ranges are of equal size. Now, there's sort of two levels of well-known problems with reasoning by indifference like this. One is a sort of technical problem of finding the uniquely correct measure so that you can say this region is of the same size as that region. And in general, there are proofs that you know, it depends what the domain you're dealing with is, if it's a continuum or something like that. But there are just an infinite number of things, all of which satisfy the axiom of measure theory, that could be adopted as measures, some of which will say there's a high probability that it should be in this range, others of which will say there's a low probability that it should have been within this range.
Science should always tell you the measure.
But the question is, where is it coming from? Here's the deal. When somebody says the universe as a whole, as it's presented to us, looks improbable, okay, I'm immediately going to want to know where the hell the speaker got their idea of what was probable and what wasn't, okay? That is, there seems to be this is something that's been in physics at least since statistical mechanics or something like that. There's been a kind of reasoning whereby it seems like we have a sort of a priori access to what probabilities ought to be. I'm sure in statistical mechanics, and I suspect more broadly, this kind of reasoning is always profoundly mistaken. Okay. In statistical mechanics, there was an odd coincidence. There is a measure which turns out to be very simply representable mathematically, has a beautiful, simple relationship to the phase space, and so on and so forth. So simple, so pretty, that one might think it's almost, it suggests itself almost a priori. But of course it doesn't. The justification for using that measure in statistical mechanics as elsewhere is its empirical success. Okay, and nothing but its empirical success. That the measure is what it is among the fundamental physical laws, like F equals ma, like the laws of gravitation. All these laws are justified by their empirical success. Okay, if that's right, okay, it's enormously puzzling to hear people say, yes, we have a simple theory of the universe. It works rather well. It includes the stipulation that this constant has this value. But you know, it's unlikely that that constant had that value. One wants to know where one is getting one's criterion of likelihood in reasoning like this. If it sounds like it couldn't be from empirical data, because all the empirical data supports the claim that the constant has that value. It sounds like there's some a priori intuition about what the constant is likely to have been. If that intuition is supposed to be genuinely a priori, that's crazy.
You're always estimating it in theory.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be calling on people.
Can I?
Yes.
I think, you know, working scientists don't work like logicians or like philosophers. Okay?
Maybe at their peril.
At their peril.
Right.
But I think that what has been going on since at least the 1970s,
right,
is partly a consequence of the fact that the wealth of experimental data has not, you know, we haven't been bombarded all the time with new experiments, with new things that we couldn't explain. So you look around at your theory, and you look at things that look uncomfortable. Why
right.
do they look uncomfortable?
Right.
Well, you know why the Higgs mass looks uncomfortable in the standard model.
Right.
So people said this. Ken Wilson said this.
Right.
And people started wondering, well, can I find some nice way to solve that problem, to make it aesthetically more pleasing? And they came up with Technicolor. And then rather quickly, we found that that doesn't work, that there's empirical data that shows that Technicolor, I mean, there are still some diehards who don't agree with this, but there seems to be a lot of empirical data that rubbed against the technicolor theories. And then a short while later, somebody else said, well, surface imagery solves this problem. And there's been an enormous amount of interest in that for many, many different reasons, okay? Many of them theoretical. But in addition to all of those reasons, it makes predictions that we're going to see something new in the LHC energy range. And we said, this is enough of a bet that we should go out and build the LHC. Okay, we're going to do it. And as Gordy says, we might even know in a couple of months whether it's true or not. We're going to take a few years from now. But we're going to know in a rather finite amount of time whether that bet was correct or not. Another example, people worried, starting with Dickey, I think, about fine-tuning of the initial conditions of the universe,
right,
homogeneity. And
right.
Isotropy come from, again, you could just say, well, I just put that in the initial conditions. That's a perfectly good theory to fix the data.
Right.
And then other people came up with theories that tried to explain
right.
where those initial conditions came from. And I'll tell you myself, I'm not even very satisfied personally with those theories as explanations of the original problem they were supposed to solve.
Right.
But what did come out of that was new empirically testable science, and we've just seen the confirmation.
That's good. No, that's great.
That's the way science is done.
That's absolutely right.
You go around searching for puzzles,
sure.
you try to solve them,
sure.
and then you see what happens, and you try to do something to predict something.
That seems absolutely right, Tom. Nothing is going to be taken away from that. I think, you know, that is what you've done is given a whole bunch of other justifications, quite independent ones, for thinking along such lines. It's going to suggest new experimental results. It's going to make other sorts of predictions. I mean, let's take a case which looks to me a little cleaner than the ones you mentioned. There's been in classical statistical mechanics, or maybe in you know, it applies the same way in quantum mechanical models or something like that. The following sorts of reasoning sometimes goes on. By the usual Lebesgue measure, the initial low entropy condition of the universe is highly improbable. Okay? There's a big mystery. There's something that requires explaining here, okay, about why the initial condition of the universe was so low entropy. Okay? Now, there may be all kinds of stories one can tell which would have all kinds of benefits. Brian is fooling around with such a story. But just as a flat, somebody comes and says, look, I don't understand where you got this probability distribution from. Here's my probability distribution. I have a probability distribution over initial states of the universe. The distribution looks like this. It's uniform relative to the standard Lebesgue measure over the region of phase space that corresponds to this initial low entropy. It's zero elsewhere. It gives a very nice, very simple account of our world, okay? If somebody says, no, but that's highly improbable, I don't have the slightest idea where they got their notion of what was probable.
In that case, don't all the estimates come from actually making an estimate of the entropy at the beginning of the universe from some other assumption and finding a bigger number than the one that you're saying we did?
Say it again, I'm not sure I understood.
You make estimates of what the entropy might be at the beginning of the universe.
Right.
From just general assumptions, you try one, you get an estimate. You try something about black holes, you get an estimate. They're always bigger than the one.
No, but I mean, there's a lot of talk in foundations of physics that it's some kind of mystery that the universe didn't start out in equilibrium, for example, okay? That's overwhelmingly the most likely state for the universe to have started out. That's a really good question, okay? I don't understand where, except empirical experience of the world, intuitions about probability distributions ought to come from. Okay, but there is very deep in physics, especially in statistical mechanics, an idea that there are sort of a priori sources of reasonable expectations about what probabilities ought to be. I didn't mean for this discussion to go on this long. Lee was begging for something from philosophers that, you know, that might disrupt some of their patterns of reasoning. And this occurred to me as something I've been puzzled about for a while off the top of my head. There's some of these, maybe I'm just wrong, and maybe what Tom's saying is that on closer examination, I'm just wrong about what the motivations for these theories are. Sometimes it looks like these theories are motivated, at least in part, by what look like a priori intuitions about what probability distributions ought to be are. And my point was just, a priori intuitions about what probabilities ought to be strike me as exactly like a priori intuitions about what dynamical laws ought to be. Where the hell did you get the idea that you ought to have an a priori intuition?
All my perceptions about probabilities are based on some calculations.
No, but calculations from what? Attempts to systematize empirical data? Okay, no. Like speculations about physical laws generally. Yes. I agree.
So, but there are things that you can talk about. I'll even mention.
David, let me try following Tom. Let me make a suggest some of the kinds of logic that we use to discuss the naturality problem. Mm-hmm. So we start off with a theory that has a scale. Okay, say grand unification. It has a scale of 10 to the 14th g. And that's the only scale that theory has. And then that theory has a mechanism of symmetry, spontaneous symmetry breaking. And then we, to make it agree with nature, we have to make the Higgs scale, the electroweak scale, come out 9 orders of magnitude smaller than
right.
the fundamental scale.
Right. Okay.
And we have a sense that that's improbable and requires explanation.
Where does that sense come from?
It comes from the amount of information. There's more to it than I said. The amount of the number, when we perform the process of renormalization,
right.
to go between the bare parameters and the renormalized parameters,
right.
the question is, how many digits do I have to specify to get close to the observed value?
Right.
Okay. And there's a relationship in which as the orders of magnitude in the ratio between the fundamental scale and the observed scale increases, the number of decimal point places that I have to specify increases. And it strikes us as improbable that a theory could be true which requires to come near the observed values, okay, a very fine specification of its fundamental.
I'm just not sure, once again, where these probabilities, once again, go back to the case of classical statistical mechanics. Somebody says people actually often do say this. Maybe the issue here has to do with believing that the only genuine fundamental laws are dynamical ones, or laws about the shape of the Hamiltonian, or the Lagrangian, and nothing. Well, so people often say, for example, the classical laws don't distinguish between past and future. There's a systematic distinction between past and future in our world. What are we going to do about that? And somebody says, what's the problem? Of course the law, you must be thinking that the only laws are F equals MA, but that's not the case. There's an additional law called the past hypothesis, that the initial conditions of the universe, that the macroscopic initial conditions of the universe were such and such. You add that law to the dynamical laws, you've got yourself a nice comprehensive account of the universe. Somebody comes back and says, no, but it's so unlikely that the initial state was this low entropy state. At this point, I lose my grip on the discussion.
So
what do you mean? Where did you get the idea that it's on? You have that there's some kind of intuition about direct contact with God.
So somehow
about what's likely.
What's bothering you is we have a way of talking where we jump from this requires explanation and we're puzzled.
Right.
Yeah, that is the amount of fine tuning we have to do.
Right.
Is puzzling.
Right.
Okay. To it's a hint of something improbable, and maybe.
Or maybe this is the way to put it. And this relates back to what Tom says. There might be all kinds of reasons, okay? Well, that is, suppose I say to you, add as a law that the parameter has this value, what Tom called putting it in by hand. Now, there might be all kinds of responses to that along the lines of, if we were to add that as a law, the resulting theory doesn't have the kind of elegance, doesn't have the kind of, doesn't have all kinds of theoretically desirable features that we normally expect it to have. We tend to be skeptical about the theory for those reasons. I think that's perfectly good. I don't think that's what happens in statistical mechanics. I think in statistical mechanics, you can add a nice, indeed, it's the other way around. There is a simple thing you can say about the initial condition, which if you add it to the dynamical laws, unifies so much, explains so much, makes everything hang together so beautifully, okay, that all of the normal sort of extra empirical criteria of theory choice, criteria of beauty or simplicity or elegance or something like that, all argue dramatically in favor of adding an additional fundamental law governing what the initial conditions were. Okay? Some people seem to understand all this, but say, but these conditions are so a priori unlikely. Okay? Whenever I hear the words a priori unlikely, I don't understand what's being asserted. It's like saying, this is what a priori the laws of the laws of motion ought to be, okay? Or this is what a priori the Hamiltonian ought to be. I completely understand the kinds of criteria that Tom was introducing. If you say, no, we could add that as a postulate, that results in an unusually ugly theory to our eyes. There are all sorts of reasons we don't like it. Now I understand what you're talking about. If you say, on the other hand, that results in a theory which is a priori has small likelihood, I have no clue what you're doing. That's the distinction. Because there really is, I think if you try to psychoanalyze Boltzmann, for example, okay, Boltzmann really did think, you know what, I've got a derivation of entropy increase here just from the dynamical laws. And nothing else, okay? Because the additional stipulation I need, which is the uniform probability over microstates compatible with the macrostate, that's just a principle of reasoning. That's akin to a law of logic, okay? If you don't know which macrostate is the one that's occupied, you ought to assign a uniform probability over them. This, if that's what he thought, and if he didn't think that, lots of physicists did, this is a really deep logical error that they're making, okay? Probability distributions are no more a priori than other laws of nature are. Our reasons for believing them ought to be just as tied to their empirical success as our reasons for believing in other laws of nature. And if somebody a priori thinks, the minute somebody says to themselves, the universe is unlikely, okay, they ought to pause for a minute and ask where the hell, except by looking at the universe, they got their idea of what was likely and what is.
I think we should probably go for lunch. Let's thank everybody again.